KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS Falls Pass.
From NPR News in Washington, D.C., this is Weekend Edition. I'm Aisha Roscoe. Good morning. President Trump addressed the conservative conference CPAC this weekend and the new heart of a GOP he's totally dominated.
Donald Trump has literally remade the conservative movement. He's remade the Republican Party.
And locals are concerned that the tight deadline for the federal cleanup of hazardous materials after the LA wildfires will leave toxic chemicals in the area. Plus, a conversation with one of Malcolm X's daughters on the anniversary of his death. She talks about what history gets wrong about her father. It's Sunday, February 23rd. News is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Nora Rahm. As the Trump administration continues to trim the federal workforce, an email asking workers to document what they did in the past week is causing confusion across agencies. NPR's Shannon Bond reports.
The email sent by the Office of Personnel Management on Saturday told workers to list five things they accomplished in the past week, but not to share any classified information. In a post on X, White House advisor Elon Musk said failure to respond to the email would be taken as a resignation. But many federal workers were left confused as supervisors gave conflicting advice. Defense Department staff were told to wait for internal guidance before replying. At the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency, officials told employees the email was a, quote, valid request. The OPM email gives workers until Monday night to respond. Shannon Bond, NPR News.
In a rare move, Israel says it's deploying tanks in the occupied West Bank, and the military plans to remain in several refugee camps there for the next year. Israel's defense minister also said tens of thousands of Palestinians who fled those areas in recent weeks will not be allowed to return. NPR's Kat Lonsdorf reports.
Defense Minister Israel Katz made the announcement as Israeli military tanks were preparing to enter the Jenin refugee camp, a built-up urban area in the northern part of the West Bank. It's the first time tanks have been deployed to the West Bank in more than two decades. Israel says this is a counter-terrorism operation. It started in Jenin more than a month ago and has since spread to other refugee camps like Tul Karim and North Shams. More than 40,000 Palestinians have been displaced. Many fled without belongings and have been living in makeshift conditions for weeks. Katz says that the Israeli military will continue to, quote, clear the refugee camps. Palestinian leaders fear that this might allow for Israel to begin to annex parts of the West Bank. Kat Lonsdorf, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
Tens of thousands of people gathered in Beirut today for a funeral for Hassan Nasrallah, nearly 5 months after the Hezbollah leader was killed in an Israeli airstrike. Voters in Germany head to the polls today to take part in a national parliamentary election that will lead to a change in government. NPR's Rob Schmitz reports from Berlin.
Today's election was supposed to happen later this year, but in November, the government of Social Democrat Chancellor Olaf Scholz collapsed over a debate on how to revive Europe's biggest economy. Voter Sabina Pago says this election is a crucial one for Germany. Politicians and the press make a big deal about immigration, said Pago, but the real issues are the economy, the gap between the rich and poor, the war in Ukraine, and the fact that the world is splitting apart. Latest polling data shows a center-right Christian Democratic Union Party as the most likely to emerge as a top vote-getter and be in the position of forming a coalition government. Rob Schmitz, NPR News, Berlin.
This is NPR News. The Vatican says Pope Francis remains in critical condition today, but he had a peaceful night. He's been in the hospital since February 14th with respiratory problems and has since been diagnosed with pneumonia. The 88-year-old pontiff had part of one lung removed as a young man. Tech investors are awaiting a crucial report card on artificial intelligence this week. As NPR's Maria Aspen reports, chip company NVIDIA will report its quarterly earnings on Wednesday.
The AI arms race has made NVIDIA into one of the most valuable companies in the world. Large tech companies are investing tens of billions into AI infrastructure, including NVIDIA's computing chips. But last month, a Chinese startup called DeepSeek rattled tech investors and made them question all this spending. After DeepSeek unveiled a lower-cost AI model, tech stocks plunged. NVIDIA alone lost more than $500 billion in market value, a record one-day loss. The company's shares have since mostly recovered, but investors will be watching NVIDIA's earnings for reassurance that demand for its chips remains high and that the tech industry's AI spending will eventually pay off. Maria Aspen, NPR News, New York.
Michaela Schifrin won her 100th Alpine Skiing World Cup today. She's the first skier, male or female, to reach triple digits in World Cup race victories. She finished the slalom 0.61 seconds ahead of her nearest competitor. She came back after she crashed during a giant slalom race in Vermont in November and had just returned to skiing last month. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at waltonfamilyfoundation.org.
In addition from NPR News, I'm Aisha Roscoe. Thanks for tuning in this morning. It's a big weekend for conservative activists around here in Washington, D.C. President Trump headlined the Conservative Political Action Conference Saturday.
We have a lot to stick together for because what we've done has never been done before. Nobody's ever seen anything like this, and nobody's ever seen 4 weeks like we've had.
And across town, a smaller group of conservatives who oppose Trump gather to talk about what's next. NPR's Stephen Fowler and Sarah McCammon have been covering these events, and they join us now. Good morning to you both.
Good morning.
Hey there.
So, Stephen, I'll start with you and CPAC. What did you hear there?
CPAC has been around for a while, but since Trump has been on the scene the last decade, you might as well call it TPAC. Here's one of Trump's pollsters, John McLaughlin, speaking just after showing a straw poll of CPAC participants found a 99% approval rating of Trump as president.
And I said, it's way more popular than even Ronald Reagan was. And I never would have said this back in the day. Donald Trump has literally remade the conservative movement. He's remade the Republican Party.
Not that there's any deviation from Trump and his administration were quashed or silenced this week, but it also stood out to me, Aisha, how seamlessly Trump 2.0's policies and language and worldview are organically reflected in virtually every aspect of CPAC.
Sarah, you were at a competing event that continues today. So how are conservatives who oppose Trump feeling right now?
Well, they're a much smaller group. I attended a summit hosted by a group called Principles First, which began during Trump's first term in opposition to his policies. And speakers there included high-profile anti-Trump Republicans, such as former U.S. Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez. He criticized several of the administration's actions so far, including the firings of federal prosecutors who investigated the January 6th attack on the Capitol.
You're doing your job successfully, and you get fired, that is a complete betrayal. I think it's a betrayal to the American people for the president to pardon, particularly those individuals that are dangerous. The president's pardon power is virtually absolute in the Constitution, so I get that he has the authority to do that. There's no question about it, but it was a wrong thing to do.
And of course, Gonzalez is referring there to Trump's pardoning of 1,500 people related to January 6th. And he said, you know, without speaking for former President George W. Bush, who he served under, he couldn't imagine Bush pardoning offenders who had harmed police officers or caused damage to the U.S. Capitol. So, Aisha, this was an opportunity for conservative-leaning activists who've largely given up on today's Republican Party to kind of regroup and try to carve out a space for those anti-Trump conservative voices.
Stephen, how are folks at CPAC reacting to Trump's first month in office?
I mean, they love it. I want to play some remarks here from Senator Jim Banks of Indiana, who encapsulated the sense that Trump is winning, has won, and will continue to win in achieving his campaign promises.
Within a short time, we've gotten just a glimpse of the greatness that will define this new era. President Trump has already rooted out massive waste, fraud, and abuse within the federal bureaucracy, crippling the corruption of the deep state.
A lot of Trump's agenda is being challenged in court. It's executive action that'll either take time to implement if it can be implemented at all, but that doesn't really matter as much because Trump is president. He says it's being done, and Republicans do hold all the federal levels of power. I'll also add a not too surprising undercurrent this week for me was Elon Musk and his Doge effort. Musk was given the rock star treatment at CPAC, and so many speakers made sure to bring up that effort to cut federal spending and reshape the government in a deferential and effusive way usually reserved for Trump.
Anti-Trump Republicans often find themselves working with Democrats these days. So, Sarah, what did they have to say about how Democrats have been responding to Trump's first month in office?
Yeah, I mean, there was plenty of criticism of Trump and Republicans at this event I attended yesterday, but there was also criticism of Democrats. I mean, these are center-right conservatives. I heard more than once that Democrats have failed to communicate to voters that they care about them and understand their concerns. One of the speakers was billionaire Mark Cuban, who endorsed Vice President Harris last year, but says he doesn't identify with any party.
You know, if you're the Democrats or you're trying to counter them, whether you're a conservative, whatever it may be, you have to recognize, you know, telling this other company's customers that they're dumb doesn't work because they're not dumb, right? They bought into what they saw in that person.
And Cuban says as the impact of some of Trump's policies starts to be felt, he thinks more voters will shift away from him, but it might take some time.
Sarah, what about all of those center-right activists and disaffected Republicans that Democrats tried to win over last fall? Do the people you talk to think they can make any progress now with Trump and his supporters fully in power?
I mean, it's been tough. You know, Trump not only won, but expanded his coalition. So there are many reasons for these kinds of activists to be discouraged. But organizers and speakers point to what they see as some hopeful early signs. Trump's approval ratings dropping this past week, reports of voters showing up at congressional town halls and protesting. So they believe there is an opportunity at this moment for centrists to work together outside the major party structures to push back against him.
And also, to Sarah's point, I mean, Trump is not going to be the leader of the Republican Party forever. He's super effective at uniting coalitions, both supporting him and opposing him. I mean, Republicans right now are at the pinnacle of power under Trump, but CPAC also didn't give any indication that there's a successor waiting in the wings to keep or grow the disparate groups that support Donald Trump.
That's NPR's Stephen Fowler and Sarah McCammon. Thank you so much to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
In Lebanon, the militant group Hezbollah today buried founder Hassan Nasrallah and another senior leader. Nasrallah was killed in an Israeli airstrike in Beirut in September. Tens of thousands of people turned out for what was essentially a state funeral. NPR's Jane Arraf joins us now from Beirut. Welcome.
Thank you.
So, Jane, it's been 5 months since Nasrallah was killed in that airstrike in Beirut's southern suburbs. Why is he being buried now?
Well, that war between Hezbollah and Israel in which he was killed essentially paralleled Israel's war with Gaza. And it was a very dangerous time in Beirut. There were waves of Israeli airstrikes, including the one that flattened the building, which killed him. So it would have been difficult to pull off a dignified funeral for someone of his stature. And Hezbollah had also planned it as a show of international support, which in some sense they did get. There were Iranian officials here today, senior Iranian officials, Iraqi officials, and of course, many, many Lebanese.
Can you describe the scene there for us?
Yeah, it was the biggest public event in years. The funeral was held in Beirut's biggest sports stadium, absolutely packed. In fact, they were turning people away. You can hear the chants there in the stadium. where the coffins were placed on essentially a truck with a glass enclosure. So these two coffins draped in yellow Hezbollah flags, which have that symbol of a green rifle, surrounded by flowers. And as it moved through the crowd, people threw things at it in the hope of blessings, scarves, pieces of clothing. And then they ran excerpts from speeches of Nasrallah. While he was speaking, people actually wept. It's really hard to get across how revered this man was, not just as a spiritual leader, a political leader, but as someone who was extremely charismatic. Israeli jets at one point flew overhead, breaking the sound barrier, and the response to that was chants of death to Israel.
Tell us about Nasrallah and who he was.
Well, he's a main founder of Hezbollah, which was created with Iranian backing to counter the Israeli invasion of Lebanon in 1982. Lebanon was, and to some extent still is, a quite a weak state, and Hezbollah was much more effective fighting force than Lebanese security forces. It also had a network of social services, so essentially in many parts of this country, it became a state within a state. The U.S. classified it as a terrorist organization after the 1983 bombing of the U.S. Embassy in Beirut. But to Nasrallah's millions of followers, he embodied resistance against the occupation, Israeli occupation of Lebanon and Israeli occupation of Gaza. In Beirut, I was here the day he was killed, and men and women were sobbing in the streets. And many of them continue to say, without Nasrallah, there would be no Lebanon.
What is the future of Hezbollah? What does this mean for the region?
Well, Israel saw him as one of their biggest threats, so killing him to them was a victory. And Nasrallah himself acknowledged before he was killed that the waves of Israeli attacks had weakened the organization. But it certainly has not destroyed it. Hezbollah Secretary General Naim Qassem addressed the funeral, and he said that the so-called axis of resistance from Yemen to Iraq to Lebanon, resistance against Israel and the U.S., would continue, and they would follow in Nasrallah's footsteps.
That's NPR's Jane Arraf speaking to us from Beirut. Thank you so much, Jane.
Thank you.
Weekend Edition is a production of NPR News, which is solely responsible for its content. Like a story you heard on this or another NPR program? Share it with a friend at npr.org. While there, you can also hear stories you missed, enjoy expanded content, or connect to your favorite member station.
You're listening to NPR News.
I'm Nora Rahm with these headlines. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky said today Russia launched 267 drones at Ukraine overnight, its largest drone attack to date. Tomorrow marks 3 years since Russia launched its full-scale invasion of Ukraine. Both French President Emmanuel Macron and British Prime Minister Keir Starmer are meeting separately with President Trump this week. They're expected to urge him not to rush into an agreement with Russia on ending the war. And the Office of Personnel Management has sent email to federal workers requiring a list of what they accomplished last week by tomorrow night. It's part of the administration's efforts to shrink the federal workforce. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 30,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public. From Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people. At WTGrantFDN.org.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Aisha Roscoe. It is Election Day in Germany. Voters are deciding which parties will serve in the next parliament and who will be the next chancellor. Germany is Europe's biggest economy, so today's vote will have big effects not only on Europe, but well beyond. NPR Berlin correspondent Rob Schmitz joins us now. Hi, Rob.
Good morning.
So this election wasn't supposed to come until later this year, so why is it happening today?
Yeah, the reason explains a big issue voters will be weighing in on today, and that's the dismal state of Germany's economy. Chancellor Olaf Scholz, a social democrat, and his libertarian finance minister fought for months about how to revive the German economy. They couldn't come to a solution, so he fired the minister last November, and that led to the collapse of their three-party coalition government and forced early elections.
What are the polls saying?
Well, all the polls show that the center-right Christian Democratic Union Party, alongside its sister party from Bavaria, the CSU, is the likely top voter getter today. Their candidate for chancellor is a longtime politician and corporate lawyer, Friedrich Merz. He's calling for a more unified Europe to stand up against an increasingly aggressive Russia, and he's advocating cutting Germany's stifling bureaucracy and regulatory system to make it easier on businesses. This morning, I spoke to voters outside my neighborhood polling site, and I spoke to voter Tobias Rascha about what Merz's priorities should be once he becomes chancellor, and here's what he told me.
We have a war in Europe. We have problems with the economy. We have still a climate issue. I expect that he is driving a stable and very strong Germany and Europe, and that we bring us together and really act like a strong player, which we are.
Rob, the far-right Alternative for Germany party is polling in second place. Does that mean they'll end up in the government?
Most likely not, and that's because all of Germany's mainstream parties have vowed never to govern with this party, known by its acronym in German, the AfD. You know, this is a party that is under domestic surveillance due to the threat that it poses to Germany's democracy. Elon Musk is a big supporter of the party, but one of the big questions hanging over this election is how many parliamentary seats that this party will get. The AfD has been polling at 20%, and that's its highest popularity ever. Another voter we spoke to, Sabina Pagel, said this about the party's threat to Germany.
Besonders groß und es wird auch noch mal größer werden in 4 Jahren, glaube ich.
And she's saying here it's vital that Germans get out and vote today because she thinks this election will decide the future of the country's democracy. She says Elon Musk and J.D. Vance's support of the AfD is tantamount to election interference. And she thinks today's election is so important for the country's future that she said she was crying when she cast her vote.
You've covered Germany for many years. What signs are you tracking today?
Yeah, I think the big question today will be whether voter support for Friedrich Merz's CDU party will be enough for him to form a two-party coalition government, or will the votes be spread out among more parties, forcing him to try and form a three-party coalition government, which is what has been governing Germany the past 4 years. And due to the differences between those parties, it has in large part failed because of internal squabbling. If Merz and another mainstream party are able to get enough votes to form a two-party coalition, then governing could be an easier and more decisive task. Whatever happens, though, it's clear that the AfD will likely have a stronger presence in parliament and on Germany's political process moving forward.
That's NPR's Berlin correspondent Rob Schmitz. Rob, thank you so much.
Thanks a lot.
A federal judge in Boston is mulling a decision that could have far-reaching implications for research across the United States. The judge could rule any day on whether the Trump administration can cut billions of dollars from overhead costs of biomedical research at universities, medical schools, and hospitals. Why do overhead costs matter? NPR health correspondent Rob Stein visited one lab to find out.
Dr. Donald Milton's a federally funded scientist at the University of Maryland School of Public Health. He's among thousands of scientists around the country funded by the National Institutes of Health who are bracing for dramatic cuts in their budgets.
Can you walk me back to your lab?
Yeah, so across the hallway here is a lab where we do our breath collections.
Milton and his colleagues collect breath from sick people to study how respiratory viruses like the flu and COVID spread from one person to another.
We do our breath collections with the Gesundheit 2, which is right behind you here.
What's it called?
The Gesundheit 2.
The Gesundheit 2 looks like a booth with clear plastic windows. Inside, there's a giant silver cone that resembles the horn of an old-fashioned gramophone. A feverish student arrives to get his blood drawn, nose swabbed, spit collected, and take a turn breathing into the big metal cone.
Have him loudly recite the alphabet. Okay. And meanwhile, they should be counting any coughs or sneezes that he makes.
To try to figure out how to protect people against the next epidemic or pandemic, like the bird flu that's infecting poultry, dairy cows, and some people.
Is it airborne? Do masks work? Are there other things that we should be doing, like making sure we have good ventilation and filtration?
The Gesundheit 2 is just one piece of equipment in just one of his labs.
We are having to replace pieces of our Gesundheit 2 because it's now going on 20 years old, you know, and stuff wears out.
In fact, Milton says about one-third of the money he gets from the NIH is for indirect costs.
The lights, the maintenance on the machinery, the heat, the air conditioning.
The Trump administration wants to cap indirect cost payments at 15%. The University of Maryland has been getting about 56%. So Milton estimates he would lose about $1.1 million, forcing him to lay off as many as half his team.
It would be really bad for our work because it would slow us down. It may prevent us from continuing the work in the longer run.
And he worries about the future of biomedical research. Most of the agency's $48 billion annual budget goes to scientists outside the agency like Milton, including about $9 billion for indirect costs.
Since World War II, the United States built up the world's most effective and successful research enterprise anywhere in human history. And we did that because the federal government supported the infrastructure that makes research possible. And that's what the indirect costs do. And without that, the whole thing crumbles.
Now, the Trump administration says many institutions could cut bloat or use their endowments to cover those indirect costs. And the NIH could use the $4 billion in savings to pay for even more research, especially outside the usual elite academic enclaves. Some outside experts agree. Avik Roy is president of the Foundation for Research on Equal Opportunity, a conservative think tank.
Rates should be reasonable for universities to cover their overhead and allow more of NIH's budget to be directed towards actual scientific research.
State attorneys general, medical schools, hospitals, and others argued in federal court in Boston that the cap on indirect cost funding would be devastating and is illegal. The judge could rule anytime. Rob Stein, NPR News, College Park, Maryland.
Baseball is trying to figure out where to draw the line with technology. And why should America's pastime be any different from the rest of the country? At spring training, Major League Baseball is testing out a new automated strike zone system that allows players to challenge calls of balls and strikes. NPR's Becky Sullivan reports from Phoenix.
There's a phrase you hear a lot around baseball these days, especially now that ABS, the automated ball strike system, has reached the major leagues for the first time.
There's a human element to this.
The human element of baseball?
The human element.
There's a human element.
That human element to umpire.
The human element, aka umpires. For more than 150 years, humans have stood behind home plate to call balls and strikes. But this new technology could one day change that. Here's how it works. A set of cameras placed around a ballpark can tell the exact location of a pitch as it crosses home plate. Tell the system what the strike zone is, and it can tell you whether the pitch was a ball or a strike. They haven't used this in the major leagues until now. This spring, MLB is running a test. Players can challenge a ball or a strike call by tapping the top of their head. An automated replay shows up on the Jumbotron, and ABS calls it a ball or strike. There won't yet be challenges in this coming regular season, but they could come to real games in 2026 if these tests go well.
I'm looking forward to seeing it in earnest.
This is Bud Black, the manager of the Colorado Rockies. He was a pitcher for six major league teams in the 1980s and 90s. You'd think an old school guy like him might resist a big change like this, but actually he says things have already changed a lot for the strike zone since his day. Back then, everyone knew the strike zone wasn't always going to match how the rule book defined it.
With some umpires, they were a little bit more liberal, and you sort of knew those guys. Other umpires were a little tighter, and you knew who those guys were. So it didn't make it good or bad one way or the other. It's just what it was.
Veterans, too, sometimes got the benefit of the doubt in a way rookies didn't.
But, you know, that was a given. That was a given, and it was okay. It was understood.
That started to change in 2001 when MLB began using technology to evaluate umpires. And for the past 15 years, the league has graded every umpire after every game. That's been a huge deal, Bob Melvin told me. He's the manager for the San Francisco Giants, used to be a catcher back in his big league days.
When I was catching, if I held a pitch or pulled a pitch from the bottom of the zone and held it there, an umpire would tell me, if you do that again, you'll never get a strike. So it's completely different now. They know they're being graded by a system, and they're just trying to get it right.
Technology has also made it easier for fans to know if calls are right between the strike zone overlay on TV broadcasts and auto-generated umpire scorecards that circulate online after games.
There's a lot of pressure on umpires now to get these calls right because there's such a spotlight, and every time they don't, you know, social media or whatever just kind of goes crazy with that.
So the league has been testing out the ABS system in the minor leagues over the past few years, and a lot of the players there have come to prefer being able to challenge.
I love it. Like, if we can get the call right every time, then why not?
Like Michael Tolia, the first baseman for the Colorado Rockies. He had a stint in AAA last season, so I asked him what his most memorable challenge was.
Like a full count strikeout to, like, just kidding, challenge, now it's a walk. Oh my gosh, that is such a difference.
I can only imagine.
Such a good feeling.
Like, what do you do after that? Like,
it changes your whole day. You sleep better.
But for some, this has raised a question. If baseball has the technology to determine balls and strikes, why bother with the human umpires at all? Well, MLB has tested that too. Infielder Cody Freeman got to try the full ABS in the Arizona Fall League. He's at camp now with the Texas Rangers. He says the fully automatic strike zone turned him off.
It just feels like it takes away from the game. You need the umpires, you need coaches, players yelling at them. They need to yell at us, and it just feels like baseball when they do that. And we don't want a robot umpire. So.
For such an old sport, baseball has changed a lot of rules lately. Designated hitters in the National League, a pitch clock to speed up the pace of the game. These were big, big deals when they were announced. But players this month at spring training in Arizona have told me they got used to that stuff quicker than they expected. Here's Tyler Gentry, an outfielder for the Kansas City Royals.
We were actually just talking about this the other day when we were doing base running, as someone pointed out, like, isn't it crazy how normal these bases feel now? Because a few years ago, they changed the size of the bases. I don't know if you remember that. And so that was something people were like, we didn't really know if it was necessary. And then you start using it, you know, hey, this is actually kind of great.
Spring training officially opened Thursday with a game between the Chicago Cubs and Los Angeles Dodgers. In the bottom of the first, with a Dodger batter on a 1-0 count, Cubs pitcher Cody Poteet threw a fastball, low and away. The ump called it a ball, but Poteet challenged it. And the ABS system came on the Jumbotron and said, actually, it was a strike. History was made in 20 seconds, the Major League's first ever ball strike challenge. From what I could tell, the fans barely noticed, and on the game went. Becky Sullivan, NPR News, Phoenix.
You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News. Now a real Mr. Smith goes to Washington moment. But instead of Washington, it's Topeka. And instead of trying to get the government to buy some land for a boys' camp, well, the everyman of our next story is petitioning his elected representatives for something a little different. We'll let Rose Conlon of member station KMUW take it from here.
In front of a panel of lawmakers in a Kansas legislative committee room, Stephen Casper rose to speak about a matter dear to his heart. For the past 4 years, he's been feeding and training raccoons in his neighborhood.
It is the highlight of my life. These are the things that you do when you become an empty nester. You start playing with raccoons in the backyard.
Having a pet raccoon is legal in at least a handful of states, but not Kansas. And with the help of a lawmaker who had a raccoon companion as a child, Casper is determined to change that.
It's like any other exotic breed. We have exotic cats that are legal, servals, Chelseas, parrots, ferrets, sugar gliders.
He's not talking about bringing wild raccoons inside, but his bill would allow people to buy domesticated raccoons from licensed breeders. They'd need to complete a course on raccoon care, keep their pets up to date on vaccines, and give them their own room or enclosure. But several veterinarians at the hearing, including some who are lawmakers, were not on board. They talked about risks with rabies and distemper. State Representative Dwayne Droege said he knows from personal experience that raccoons are unruly.
I had a roommate in veterinary school that had one that just took over the refrigerator. It would hide until you opened the refrigerator door and it had to take over the refrigerator and you couldn't even go in the kitchen.
After the hearing, I called Casper, who works in sales in the Kansas City area. He says raccoons are victims of misinformation.
They are extremely intelligent. They problem solve. They are phenomenal little creatures. But then there's the other part of it is, when you really get to know them, they are the most affectionate, goofy little things on the face of the earth.
He feeds them fruit and vegetables, and in videos online, marshmallows out of his hand.
Come here, sweetheart. You want this? Do you want this? Of course you do.
He says it all started on the back deck of his suburban home with one raccoon. His name was Robbie.
I could go out at 6 a.m. and he'd hang around and I'd have my coffee in my hand and I'd yell, Robbie, Robbie. And here he'd come right up the stairs. He wanted some treats and toys and he would play for a little bit and then he was on his way.
The bill has been opposed by the state health department and was not voted on in the committee. Casper says he knows the push to legalize pet raccoons will be an uphill battle.
There's been some naysayers, but I would tell you that overwhelmingly, this is a very popular movement. So it's not going away.
Whatever happens, Casper says, he is not giving up. For NPR News, I'm Rose Conlin in Wichita, Kansas.
Careless way she throws a lace about her shoulders and her face. The way she moves around the place stops you cold.
Now, 9 years after Guy Clark's death, there's a new album from the singer-songwriter. Where have these recordings been all this time, and what do they show about Guy Clark's legacy? Find out later today on All Things Considered. Tune in with your phone, your smart speaker, or your radio.
Can I say about her? Raggedy Ann's her name.
This is NPR News.
Growing up in a South African township, Abel Salauchwe decided his cello could be more than an instrument. It could be a bridge across cultures and genres. That story on the next morning edition from NPR News.
I'm Nora Rahm with these headlines. The FBI director has told his employees not to respond to an email sent to federal workers to list their accomplishments in the past week. Kash Patel said the agency will review its own processes. The Israeli defense minister said today Israel is deploying tanks in the occupied West Bank as part of a counterterrorism operation. The military also plans to remain in several refugee camps there for the next year. And Japan's emperor marked his 65th birthday today with a plea that citizens keep telling the tragedy of World War II to younger generations. This year marks the 80th anniversary of the end of the war. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Indeed, designed to be an end-to-end hiring solution for businesses of all sizes to attract, interview, and hire candidates all from one platform. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. From Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort, offering small ship experiences with a shore excursion included in every port and programs designed for cultural enrichment. Learn more at Viking.com. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Aisha Roscoe. It's a massive cleanup operation facing a deadline this week. President Donald Trump gave the Environmental Protection Agency just 30 days to remove hazardous waste left by the devastating wildfires in California. Millions of tons of ash and debris were created after the fires tore through the Pacific Palisades and Altadena, burning thousands of homes and properties to the ground. But now some residents are protesting against the decision to dump hazardous materials at local landfills. Tony Briscoe is an environmental reporter with the Los Angeles Times and joins us now. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me, Aisha.
The amount of debris makes this one of the biggest cleanups in California's recent history. So just how much progress has been made?
Yes. So we're nearing the completion of the first phase of this cleanup. And so that is the hazardous materials removal by the EPA. They've cleared about 7,000 of the 13,000 properties. And I think that there are serious concerns about the amount of time that federal cleanup crews have been given. In concept, you know, it's great if we can remove as much hazardous materials. You're talking about things like batteries, pesticides, firearm ammunition, propane tanks, anything that can't normally go to a local landfill from these properties. But there's serious questions about the thoroughness of the cleanup, because this really paves the way for the longer cleanup, the second phase, where you're removing ash, rubble, and debris. The last thing you want is for a bulldozer or an excavator that's removing a lot of this ash and rubble to encounter something that could potentially explode or catch fire, because that endangers workers.
The EPA handles kind of the first part of that cleanup that you were talking about, the visible hazardous materials, and then it's the Army Corps of Engineers that handles that second phase that you're talking about. And how long does the Army Corps have to do that?
So they're aiming to finish within a year, which in relation to past major wildfires, it's a really staggering clip that they're operating under. I mean, I believe it was 18 months for the cleanup of Lahaina, and we're trying to cut that down by a significant portion with a lot more properties. And you also have to realize that a lot of this stuff contains chemicals that there is no safe level of exposure to. So people are concerned about the way it's being handled, where it's going. And so what we've seen recently is for, you know, that Army Corps side of the cleanup, folks who live near these local landfills that typically don't accept high levels of toxic chemicals, communities rallied and actually were protesting and objecting to the decision to take what we know contains toxic chemicals to non-hazardous waste landfills.
One of the issues that has been raised is that the federal government is refusing to test soil under properties burnt to the ground. Why is that significant?
Yeah, so for pretty much every wildfire in the last 20 years in California, they follow a specific set of protocols meant to ensure wildfire survivors are returning to clean properties. They are removing the hazardous materials, they remove the ash and rubble that's left behind, and then they remove an initial layer of topsoil, and then they do soil testing to make sure that the soil that they leave behind doesn't contain an excess level of chemicals above California's cleanup standards. Because the last thing that you want is for people to rebuild or to go back to properties that are still contaminated. In this instance, FEMA is not paying for soil testing, which has caused quite an uproar. A lot of folks didn't realize that. State officials are really concerned. They're urging them to reconsider, but it seems that FEMA says that they are unwilling to do this because they believe that there might be legacy contamination, and they don't believe that any contamination that might be left behind is tied to the fires.
What can residents expect to happen next?
After the first phase, we will move on to the second phase where homeowners have the decision to opt into that federal cleanup. They can also choose to hire private contractors. It's really moving at a lightning pace. But after debris, ash, and soil is removed in this second phase of the cleanup, you know, there's no restrictions on rebuilding. Actually, rebuilding permits are being applied for right now. They have a center for that. So we could see rebuilding very soon after. The question is, will large swaths of these communities still be contaminated? And we still don't know the answer to that.
That's Tony Briscoe, environmental reporter with the Los Angeles Times. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
It's news that has shaken or perhaps stirred the entertainment industry. Amazon MGM Studios is taking creative control over a certain secret agent.
Mr.
Bond. James Bond.
For decades, the intellectual property rights to the 007 franchise belonged to a British-American family. Now they're stepping back. It's big news for Bond fans across the pond, where Bond is actually from, and where our correspondent Lauren Freyer reports.
When news of Amazon's takeover of the Bond franchise hit the United Kingdom, the collective response sounded kind of like this.
I nearly dropped my coffee, and I thought Amazon Prime spin-off TV series.
No.
That's Francis from Norfolk, England, who called into a BBC talk radio program that did not include callers' surnames, but did include their outrage. Another caller, Peter from Kent, England, said he fears this deal will lead to the Americanization of Bond. Imagine the horror.
They're probably going to turn it into another Bourne Identity type thing and use it to boost American patriotism.
A headline in the Daily Telegraph newspaper reads, Amazon's Bond takeover is an assault on Britishness. The article asks whether the next Bond might be played by Tom Cruise or even by Jeff Bezos. Maybe Bond will start calling his dinner jacket a tuxedo or even give up martinis for Kentucky bourbon. That would be sacrilege, says Ajay Chowdhury, spokesperson for the James Bond International Fan Club, which is based in England, by the way.
You know, James Bond, especially in the UK, is part of our cultural heritage. It's a cultural heirloom.
After all, the creator of Bond was Ian Fleming, a Brit, though it was an American, Cubby Broccoli, who first brought Bond to the big screen in the 1960s. His British-American heirs are the ones who are ceding creative control now to MGM Amazon. Chowdhury, the fan club spokesperson, compares the Broccoli family to one of the most beloved coaches in English football, and you will not hear him call it soccer.
Have done an amazing job. They're like the Alex Ferguson of the James Bond team. They're fantastic. They've been a great management, but they can't last forever. They were never going to.
Speaking to the BBC, he then concluded with a joke. How many Bond fans does it take to change a light bulb? One, but 10 to complain about how much better the original was. Lauren Freyer, NPR News, London.
If you're not ready to die for it, put the word freedom out of your vocabulary. Those were the words of Malcolm X, who was assassinated 60 years ago on February 21st. The civil rights leader was the public face of the Nation of Islam for many years and voiced the collective frustration of Black Americans during the Jim Crow era. Unlike some Black leaders, he did not advocate nonviolence, but a doctrine of equality by any means necessary.
Faced with the brutality that they've experienced in this country for 400 years, and the inability or unwillingness of the government to protect us against this brutality, then if the Negro intends to be recognized and respected as a man, he should do whatever is necessary to defend himself in the same way that whites have done to defend themselves.
Malcolm X's family says popular images of him speaking with a raised fist or holding a gun don't capture the whole man.
For a long time, many people had been miseducated about who my father was, and I think it may have been intentional.
His daughter, Ilyasa Shabazz, was just 2 years old when her father was murdered in front of her in New York City. She told me how her mother, Betty Shabazz, kept Malcolm X's spirit alive after his death.
We had his shoes, clothes, his briefcase, his books in our study. And when we did something great, she'd say, oh my goodness, Daddy would be so proud of you. Or, you know, if we did something that wasn't so great, she would, you know, let us know. Daddy would not approve. She made sure that we knew Malcolm, the man, the husband, the father, the son, the brother. It wasn't until I went to college that I fully learned about Malcolm X, the icon.
Malcolm X, the icon. A lot of people think about Malcolm X. They may think of that picture of him looking out the window with the gun, kind of militant Black nationalist leader. What do you want us to know about your father?
My father was a young, responsible, purpose-driven individual. My father just insisted that his country live up to their promise of liberty and justice for all of its citizens. And when we see Malcolm, you know, with his fist up and talking passionately, it is usually the reaction to the bombings, to the lynchings, to the injustices that were happening. And Malcolm challenged the government for, you know, these injustices, and not really just the government. He said it's individuals who are behind policy and laws and so forth, and that we need to come together and change these things that are causing us to be so divisive.
Your father joined the Nation of Islam, a Black nationalist group. People would say it was more separatist when it came to race. It was more anti-Semitic. But he later distanced himself from that organization and converted to more mainstream Islam. What do you think about that part of his legacy?
Aisha, we're talking about the 1950s. It was the height of segregation. And so the Nation of Islam was much like the Universal Negro Improvement Association. Community building, you know, a place where you're worshiping God and you're also learning about who you are as a Black person, because we were called Negroes. Now, remember, he joins the Nation of Islam when he was in his 20s, mm-hmm. and he was gunned down at 39. So this is all a very young man who's quickly evolving with purpose and intention, giving back to society, wanting to make it better for all of us. He said, if you put a knife in my back 9 inches and you pull it out 6 inches, the knife is still in my back. There's no progress. If you pull it all the way out, that's not progress. There's an open wound. Progress is healing the wound that the blow made. But in order to heal the wound that the blow made, we have to acknowledge the fact that the knife has been in my back. And those are the kinds of instructional things that he was doing with his life.
Well, talk to me about that evolution.
Sure. You know, when he was in prison, his elder sister, Ella Collins, she got him to transfer to another prison simply because she said that there is a superior library. So my father was always an avid reader. But we first have to recognize, when you're 15, you're not the same person when you become 20, right? Hopefully you have matured in some way. When you become 25, you've matured in another way, when you become 30. So when people say, oh, you know, Malcolm went to the Middle East and he was a new man, he no longer believed in white man's the devil and all of these things, Malcolm just grew up. He continually evolved as we all do. It just so happens that he was a man of ethical, character-based values. He also recognized the injustices. He recognized the misinformation, miseducation. There were a lot of things that he recognized because he was such an avid reader in so many different topics.
I want to ask you one more question. As someone who lost their father early on, I lost my father early on. You often live your life and you're thinking what you would have liked him to see, what you would have liked to know about him. How do you think about your life as the daughter of Malcolm X and what you would want him to think about you and what you've done?
That is so sweet, Aisha. I do believe that the people that were very near and dear to us, I believe our ancestors are out there, that my father knows the work that I've done. I think that he would be proud because it was just so unfair to allow these inaccurate stories of him to persist. We have these, you know, poems that he wrote, and you get to see his heart. You get to see that he's a visionary. You get to see his compassion. A gentleman that just finished his book, Malcolm Before X, he just said that Malcolm was the star debater. He was a brilliant young man. He read the dictionary because he wanted to know the root of words, the etymology, so that he could be his best self. And he was his best. And so it's things like that that's just wonderful. And why would I just die without making some effort to ensure, just as my mother was safeguarding her husband's legacy, that we would make it available for young people, because his work is too important for it not to. His work can be beneficial to new generations.
Ilyasa Shabazz is the third daughter of Malcolm X. He was shot and killed 60 years ago. Thank you so much for sharing the memories of your father and your mother. And thank you so much for speaking with us today.
It's been an honor. And anytime you want to talk, I'm here.
This is Week in Edition from NPR News. I'm Aisha Roscoe.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Cunard, with round trips from Miami to the Caribbean on Cunard's Queen Elizabeth. Guests can dine on flavors of the Caribbean and explore local life on shore in Antigua, Barbados, St. Lucia, and beyond. Learn more at Cunard.com. From Progressive Insurance with Snapshot, which monitors safe driving habits to determine a personalized rate, at Progressive.com. Not available in California or from all agents. And from listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
Fiber Plus Internet is now available in Sandpoint and King Cove. GCI offers high-speed internet in your community at the same plans and pricing as in Anchorage. More information is available at gci.com/internet.
Traveling down the lonely highway, no, not where. Not a penny in my pocket, all alone without a friend, in a
our little country village, I met a man and he was blind. As I helped him cross the highway,